Okay, everybody. Hello, everybody. Sorry to cut across your conversations. There's going to be a great chance for you to follow up on those conversations a bit later on. My name's Ben, and I'm going to be speaking to you this morning. You'll have to excuse my voice. I have a little bit of a rough throat from a sore cough. Sorry. Hello, everybody. Oh, there we go. Lovely. You know what? I can hear you so much more in this venue. It's quite interesting, different thing. I just wanted to say, as I open up this morning, my name's Ben. I'm one of the leaders here along with Andrew and Matt. And my family grew recently in January, as many of you know. And I just wanted to say thank you so much to everybody who supported us over these last couple of months, whether it's with prayer, whether it's with food. We have been fed marvelously. Thank you so much to all those people who provided that. And just also with encouragement. It's been such a joy to be part of this church over this last couple of months and just to receive all that support. It's wonderful. Thank you. Well done, Grace Church. I know that we're not the first family to receive that support, and I'm sure we won't be the last. And it's great. It's a wonderful culture, so thank you. This time of year, I think, makes everyone start to feel a bit more hopeful, doesn't it? Yesterday, we had proper sunshine. It was actually a little bit warm, dare I say it. And we know we've got the spring and the summer ahead. And it is, it's just, I love the spring. Spring is my favourite time of year. The flowers coming out, all of that. But through the winter months, I've been watching a bit of telly. I like to curl up in front of a bit of crime, a bit of legal drama. Don't know about you. Helen and I took a couple of months of Netflix recently. And we've been getting into The Good Wife, this long-running saga about a female lawyer and her family. And her practice. I don't know if many of you watch it. It's quite easy watching in a lot of ways. It's interesting too. Maybe you're more of a silent witness type or death in paradise if you want something nice and cheesy. Murder mystery books maybe might be your thing. Or John Grisham. Or maybe you don't like any of that stuff. But the quantity of material that's out there does show just how interested people are in that. And it's because it has a big influence on our society, doesn't it? Have you ever thought, though, what the police and the courts and all this lot are for? You see, pretty much every society has police and courts and all that stuff. But why do they have it? Enforcing the law, you might say. But why? I believe the courts and the law and all that lot are there. Really, they're there to remove the bad from society, to pull it out. And the idea of removing the bad from society isn't to impoverish society. The idea is to remove the bad so that the good in society can flourish. If we were constantly going about in total fear of our lives, thinking that everything was going to get stolen at any moment, we wouldn't be able to live a normal life. And in some parts of the world, that is the reality. There is no law and order, and people have to live like that. But what the law defines as good and bad, though, and what we choose to remove from our society will shape the kind of society that we have. Now, I think we can all agree that the world does contain plenty of good, like the generosity of friends and the joys of nature. But the world also does contain plenty of bad, and it contains plenty of injustice. How is it fair? If you're born in the Sudan today, your life expectancy is 20 years less than if you're born in this country, through no fault of your own, through no cause of your own. How is that fair, or how is that just? How is it fair that children should be abused, and their abusers then shielded from justice by institutions? People, the BBC should shield celebrities, that brothers in other churches, our Christian brothers, would shield abusive church leaders and thereby perpetuate abuse under the guise of God's love. How is that just? How is it fair that a Cornish child growing up on a deprived estate may never see the beach? And yet, the child of a millionaire with a second or third home in Rockwood would play gaily there with a loving family. How is it fair or just? How is it fair that these things happen? Well, it's not. See, what this world needs is a good clean out. What this world needs is a load of bad removing from it and the good to be allowed to flourish. It needs a better justice. It needs a more fair, a more clear-eyed, and a more powerful court than any that we've seen to date. And it's not just me that thinks that. In fact, if we look at the accounts of Jesus' life, we find, thank you, Andy, we find that Jesus thinks that too. I'd like to read a small part from Matthew's record of Jesus' life. If you've got a Bible with you, it's Matthew chapter 13. And it goes like this. Jesus is talking to the crowds at this point. He's speaking to a crowd of people who have come to hear what he's got to say. And Jesus told them another parable. The kingdom of heaven is like a man who sowed good seed in his field. But while everyone was sleeping, his enemy came and sowed weeds among the wheat and went away. When the wheat sprouted and formed heads, then the weeds also appeared. The owner's servants came to him and said, "Sir, didn't you sow good seed in your field? Where then did the weeds come from?" "An enemy did this," he replied. The servants asked him, "Do you want us to go and pull them up?" "No," he answered, "because while you're pulling up the weeds, you may uproot the wheat with them. Let them both grow together until the harvest. And then at that time, I will tell the harvesters, first collect the weeds and tie them in bundles to be burned. Then gather the wheat and bring it into my barn." We're just going to skip along a little bit to Jesus' explanation. So a little while later, his disciples came to him and said, "Explain to us that parable, that story you told of the weeds in the field." He answered, "The one who sowed the good seed is the Son of Man. The field is the world, and the good seed stands for the people of the kingdom. The weeds are the people of the evil one, and the enemy who sows them is the devil. The harvest is the end of the age, and the harvesters are the angels. As the weeds are pulled up and burned in the fire, so it will be at the end of the age. The Son of Man will send out his angels, and they will weed out of his kingdom everything that causes sin and all who do evil. They will throw them into the blazing furnace, where they will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. Then the righteous will shine like the sun in the kingdom of their Father. Whoever has ears, let them hear." It's quite serious sounding, isn't it? Now, you might be sitting there thinking, look, I was never 100% sure about this Jesus guy, and now the preacher appears to have picked one of his wackier moments. This is not going to be a lot of fun. And if that is your reaction, I'd just like to say, I don't think that's an abnormal reaction. And some people really obsess over this kind of end time stuff and start predicting the date of the end of the world, which is, I'm not going to do that. But today what I'm really hoping to do is to explain why what is often called the apocalypse or judgment day isn't simply a little bit daunting, but is actually also quite exciting. Jesus here describes the apocalypse, the end of the world as we know it, not as an event principally to be afraid of, although we will get to that as well. Instead, Jesus describes this event as the start of something new and far better than before. If you were here a few weeks ago, you might remember me talking about the kingdom of God and how Jesus established the rule of God, the direct loving rule of God over people, and how one day it will be completed. So this diagram, I think we've seen a couple of times during this preaching series, but if you're new to it, time's going that way. Jesus is first coming to earth is here, and the second coming of Jesus, which is the thing he's talking about, is there, and we're in between. When Jesus came to earth, he established the kingdom of God, the direct rule of God over people. But it isn't complete. He does, not everybody fully is fully under the rule of God, the loving rule of God. But there is a time coming when Jesus will return and the kingdom will be consummated or completed. It'll be fully here. And that is the time that I'd like to spend a little bit of time thinking about right now. I'd like to spend some time focusing on the end of this passage, where it says, "Then the righteous will shine like the sun in the kingdom of their Father," because this is the purpose of everything that goes before. And it's worth getting in our minds what the purpose of it is. This phrase, "the righteous will shine like the sun in the kingdom of their Father," is a description of life on earth and in heaven after the return of Jesus. Yes, Jesus said that one day he's going to come back. That's the Son of Man in this passage. And yes, I said life on earth. Jesus is really clear about this. Not so clear here, perhaps, but in other parts of stuff that he said. And also a number of people in the young church just after Jesus had gone reflected back on this and taught the same thing. We aren't going to be floating away after the return of Jesus into some cloud-based angelic existence. We're going to continue life on earth, but it is going to be very, very different. Now, I hope that everyone here has had at least one experience that they can say they felt close to God at some point. Perhaps you wouldn't describe it as close to God if you're not a believer in God, but you may have had a time when you felt connected to something higher. Well, it might be that time happened when you were maybe walking out in nature, walking down the coast and seeing a bird fly free, and you suddenly had that moment. Perhaps staring up at the sky and you see the stars laid out above you and you think, "Wow, God, that is amazing what you've created." Maybe you connect to God best when you're reading, and you can think back to a time when your mind led your heart into close connection with him. It might be that you connect best with God on a Sunday morning or other time of singing worship to him. For you, is it when you're running, maybe, or out playing sport, or maybe you get that sense of, "Well done," or "I made you for this," coming from outside yourself when you do something selflessly for someone else. There are many ways that we can connect to God. But I'd just like you to take you on a thought journey. And I'd like you to grab hold of one of those moments. You might find it easier to engage on this journey if you close your eyes, but you don't have to do that. If you're uncomfortable doing that, there's no compulsion to. But I'd like you to think now. Can I ask you to go back to, even if it was a fleeting moment, a moment of closeness to God? And if you have many, just pick the most vivid. Imagine that moment and that experience. But instead of it being fleeting, having that stretch out over a long time, hours perhaps. Now, imagine your everyday life, not just with your normal everyday emotions and feelings, but with that sense of the closeness of God running all the way through it. Waking up in the morning, washing, eating breakfast, going about your daily routine. Every part of your day, not just thinking occasionally maybe about the large or thinking about your connection with God, but having that direct relationship with him. Now, please don't imagine that this is disconnecting you from life around. No, instead, you find that it is connecting you deeply with life around, not only do you know that sense of connection with God? But every action and thought is known, you know, is more soaked with meaning and purpose. Looking back on the day before, it seems as if you were walking through a mire with clouded thoughts and a numb body. But now? Now you can think and feel and see properly. All weariness and all tiredness is gone. Now, expand that experience again. Not only you, but every single person who you meet in your day isn't just living everyday life, but they also know a direct connection to God. They know him deeply, and they know his presence. Nowhere that you go that day is there anyone in any pain. No one, not a single one. No one is sick. There are no colds. There's no flu. Those who you knew to be suffering from chronic diseases are entirely healthy and well. And that includes you. As you go about your daily business, you realize no one else is out to get anyone else. There's no enmity. Although I dare say there's still some friendly competition. And what's more, this doesn't just last a day, because you go to sleep and wake up the next day. And it goes on, day after day, week after week, and month after month. As time goes by, you realize this is how it was always supposed to be. Everything just works, and everything feels right. Life centered on God, and without the struggle of evil in today's world. You can open your eyes now. That's the life that Jesus is talking about for the righteous, shining like the sun, being the way that we were made to be. But he also talks about another possible destiny. He pictures this as a blazing furnace where there is weeping and gnashing of teeth. This is where those who don't want to be with God, who choose, they don't want that connection with God, they don't want to be in relationship with God. They are people of the evil one, as Jesus puts it. Now, this is no kind of hell from fairy tales with a Satan who has a great time ruling the place and torturing his subjects. It's no party full of exciting sin that anyone would want to be at. No, this is a place of eternal pain and suffering. It's full of injustice and chaos. And there's no beauty, there's no love, and there's no kindness at all. And ultimately, the suffering that Jesus is describing here is down to the separation of those people from the source of all good in this world, which is God. This is what Jesus is talking about. In reflecting on this, the 20th century scholar C.S. Lewis put it like this: it's a serious thing to live in a society, our society today, of possible gods and goddesses. To remember that the dullest and most uninteresting person you can talk to may one day be a creature which, if you saw it now, you'd be strongly tempted to worship. Can you imagine that? Think of the dullest and most uninteresting person in your life. Imagine that when one day they may be transformed into a creature that you today would be strongly tempted to worship. Isn't that amazing? Or else, a horror and a corruption such as you now meet, if at all, only in a nightmare. all day long, we are in some degree helping each other to one or other of these two destinations. There are no ordinary people. You've never talked to a mere mortal. Nations, cultures, arts, civilizations, these are all mortal. Isn't that crazy? All those things that we think of as great and outstanding and grand, they're all mortal. And their life is to ours as the life of a gnat. But it is immortals who we joke with, who we marry, who we snub and exploit. Immortal horrors or everlasting splendors. And he goes on, your neighbor is near enough the holiest object presented to your senses. But how will that day be accomplished? Coming back to Jesus' words, you see, evil and injustice that we see in this world, the stuff that prevents the world from working as it should work, doesn't just upset and anger us. It angers God too, because he has that picture of how the world should be, how the righteous should shine like the sun. He sees so clearly both the causes and the outcomes of evil and injustice, and God deeply understands and hates it. This extreme form of anger that God has is often called the wrath of God. And it flows out of his sense of justice, not just his sense of justice, but the reality of his justice. And when I said earlier that Jesus thought at some point that this world needs a good clean out, he meant that true justice would be served. That the world would be cleaned out and made right. And that all of the evil would be got rid of. So, where does this bring us? You see, if what Jesus said was true, then it brings us to a point where we really want to know, don't we, how we can end up on the right side of this justice. And faced with justice, we can often feel a bit afraid. I remember the first time I went out with a large group of friends out in the middle of Truro in the evening. And I was out with this gang of friends. We were kind of walking through town in the evening. And we saw the police. I saw a couple of policemen come the other way. And I hadn't done anything wrong. And I wasn't planning on doing anything wrong. But the sense of being one of those in the group of teens who, you know, sometimes looked on as causing unsociable behaviour and all of that, suddenly made me feel a bit, what are they going to do? What are they going to say? What's going to happen? A little bit of, I could get on the wrong side of this. That feeling lives with me to this day, and I can't fully explain it, but I don't know if maybe you've had any experience like that. I also remember a time university, I don't quite know why I went, but there was a protest against the Chinese president coming to the UK. And he was visiting the university, going to see the library there, this big fancy, I think it was, yeah, he went to visit the university library. And there were a load of protesters gathering. Somebody told me it was happening. I thought I'd go to see what was happening, go and see the spectacle of what was going on. And all of the people who were there to greet the Chinese president and show signs of support were in one area, and all the protesters who were protesting against him being there, and particularly protesting against the treatment of people in Tibet, were all sort of down the road as well with all their signs and banners. And I went in behind them. And as the time drew closer for this Chinese president to arrive, the police sort of were there and marshalling the whole thing, and they've slowly gathered up all the protesters and said, "Oh, sorry, we'll need to move you over here because we need to get access through here." So, you know, being good citizens and, you know, all of that, all of us protesters. Well, I was kind of getting caught up in the mush by this point. All of us protesters got pulled along into this group and thought, "Fine, well, we'll just protest from here." And then, as the Chinese president arrived, a fleet of police vans drove in front of all of us so that the Chinese president would not have to see any of these protesters, any of this stuff saying, "We don't want you here, we disagree with your presence." And all he'd be able to see would be those waving flags and very pleased to see him. Now, I don't know about you, but that got me a bit angry. It got me really upset. And I had no real reason to be there because I was not part of some long-standing protest movement. I didn't really know exactly what was being protested against, but I got really quite upset about it because I thought, we're supposed to have free speech in this country. We're supposed to be able to protest, and they've put all these vans across. So I started leading a chant. What do we want? Free speech. When do we want it? Now. What do we want? Free speech. When do we want it? Now. And everyone joined in. And this whole crowd of people around me were joining in. And then I saw, in the distance, a couple of people walking towards a university official and clearly whoever was in charge of the police squadron. And I could see them eyeing me up because they could see me. And I was, needless to say, I soon kind of ducked out and ran away because I wasn't really quite sure how this was going to end up. I didn't really have a good reason to be there. Anyway. You can get on the wrong side of justice, and we don't want to be on the wrong side of justice. We get afraid of justice, I think, because of a few factors, and there's a few different reasons. Either the rules are bad, or we don't know what the rules are, and so we think, "Oh, I might fall foul of something I don't know about." Perhaps we do know the rules, but we know we've broken them. A few years ago, Helen and I and the family went up to Stroud to go at Christmas time to join a big family event. Helen's parents had rented a house, and her and her sister's family and our family were all up in this house together, and it was Christmas Eve, and we were partly in charge of Christmas dinner. And last minute, on Christmas Eve, we suddenly realized we didn't have a vital ingredient. I can't remember what that vital ingredient was at this moment. But it was a vital ingredient that was missing. So we were near Stroud, and I said, "Fine, I'll hop in the car, I'll go to Stroud." I drove to Stroud, not a place that I know very well. And I'm looking for the supermarket. And I can't find the supermarket. And I'm driving around, my mind's on the supermarket. I'm driving around what looks like a ring road to me. I'm thinking, is it this way? So I'm sure I saw a sign back there somewhere going this way. And all of a sudden, flash, speed camera. Oh, I've been hit by a speed camera. I've been caught by a speed camera. And I, immediately through my mind goes the list of excuses. Was it properly signed? Can I get away from this? Can I get out of it? What can I do? And it's nothing I could do, was there? I've been caught by the speed camera. And it played on my mind for days and days afterwards, thinking, when we get home, there's going to be a letter. And there was no letter. When I got home, I thought, when's it going to turn up? It'll be another week or two. It never turned up. I've never had that letter. So I guess the thing must have been out of film or something. Either that or someone was just feeling very merciful. We get scared because we do know that we actually break the rules sometimes, don't we? We also can be afraid of justice because we think maybe we're not going to get... Some people don't get fair trials, do they? The judge or the jury don't give a fair trial. And it might be because they're deliberately biased, or it might be they don't know all the facts. Those who are judging us don't know all the facts. It's like when I was in Sainsbury's last night, and I don't know if you've seen it on the tills now, they have round up your bill for Sport Relief. And I thought, well, I like to think about what I'm giving. I don't particularly want to round up my bill for Sport Relief. And the guy on the checkout says to me, your bill is currently £19.85. Sort of hinting, I'm thinking, I don't want to round up my bill. I'm not going to round up my bill. I'm not going to do it. I didn't do it. And And I put in my card, and I didn't round up my bill. I didn't give 15p to Sport Relief. I'm sorry, okay, everyone. But I thought, he doesn't know that I do give. He doesn't know, but I can't tell him because that would be make it, what do I do? And we get into it, don't we? People don't know the full picture. What if those who are judging us don't know the full picture? In these cases, but coming back to the point in question, which is slightly more large than the guy at the checkout in Sainsbury's wondering if I'm just a mean old sod. In this case, do we need to be afraid? Well, I can say for sure that God does see clearly. God does see into our hearts and he discerns our true motivations. He knows exactly what's happened. When Jesus comes to judge the world, when he comes to return, he will know exactly the truth of what's happened. We don't need to worry about that. God is fair. And in Jesus' description, he's not really talking about judging according to some defined set of rules per se. In fact, Jesus says in other places and other times that the long lists of rules that you can find in some parts of the Bible basically boil down to two things: loving and obeying God and loving your neighbor as much as you love yourself. You see, he talks about doing evil here, but then he contrasts it with being righteous. See, to be righteous means to be in good standing with God. If you spend some more time digging around the stuff that Jesus says, we soon start to see that the righteous are those that follow him. Yes, they do as he asks, but they do that out of relationship with him and a belief that he's reliable and good, not a fear that he's going to strike them down on the last day. But here is the problem. You see, not one of us can say that we trusted Jesus fully, that we have or continue to follow him without fault, and we often end up trusting other things or other people. And ultimately, even if only in small part, we all know, even if you don't believe in Jesus, you know that you contributed to the evil in this world in some part. Now, I really, really want to spend an eternity with Jesus. I really want to spend an eternity in the new heaven and new earth. I don't want to end up on the blazing furnace, I'll be honest. So how do we dig ourselves out? Well, we don't. And we can't. And we won't. We will never dig ourselves out. You see, each of us deserves to be on the blazing furnace, not to spend eternity in the new heaven and new earth. But instead of digging ourselves out, Jesus decided to rescue us. I'd like to read a little bit written by a guy called Paul, who was around a while after Jesus' death and started a number of churches during the time he was alive. He wrote it in a letter to some people in a place called Thessalonica. If you've got a Bible, it's 1 Thessalonians chapter 5. And he says this: "Now, brothers and sisters, about times and dates, we do not need to write to you, for you know very well that the day of the Lord will come like a thief in the night. While people are saying peace and safety, destruction will come on them suddenly, as labor pains on a pregnant woman, and they will not escape. But," and he goes and he talks around a bit and then says, "but since we belong to the day, let us be sober, putting on faith and love as a breastplate and the hope of being saved as a helmet. For God didn't appoint us to suffer wrath," well, that's good news, "but to be saved through our Lord Jesus Christ. He died for us, so that whether we are awake or asleep, we may live together with him." God saves us through Jesus. Jesus died for us. To join Jesus in the new heaven and new earth, we simply ask him to save us. You see, at the end of his public ministry, Jesus was killed. On the face of it, he was killed because the authorities at the time found him threatening. In reality, the nature of his death had been predicted hundreds of years before, and he predicted it himself during his life. Jesus died a torturous death on the cross, and in punishment for our contribution to the evil in this world, our contribution, he died, an entirely innocent man, and he took the full anger of God. God, who knows what evil and injustice is doing to this world far better than we do, that total anger, Jesus took it for us. He took the anger of God. However, perhaps the band could start coming up. However, just days later, Jesus rose from the dead. His resurrection, Jesus' resurrection is proof that what he said about the end times is true. That Jesus now has the first resurrection body, living in perfect and robust health and in direct relationship with God, his Father. He is living with his Father, and he will come back one day, as he said. That the reason we know this is true, the reason we know this is happening, is because Jesus rose from the dead. See, Jesus invites us to give up a life centered on ourselves and instead ask him to be the center of our lives. He invites us to abandon living for temporary and fleeting purposes and instead live for eternity. That eternity that we pictured earlier. Not living for today, but living for eternity. An eternity of fulfillment in our work, joy in our relationships, and peace in our sense of genuine purpose. We're going to share some bread and juice now. And we do this because Jesus asked us to remember his death in this way, by sharing this simple meal together. So I would invite you, if you would like to give up living, if you'd like to give up living for the temporary, living for the moment, if you want to raise your eyes from present struggles and instead lift your eyes to what is coming, can I invite you to come and share in this simple meal where we remember Jesus' death and resurrection? We're going to sing a song. Please come up while we're singing the song. And if it's the first time you're coming up to do that, I'd love to pray with you and to talk to you. So please do come and find me. I'll be here at the front. Okay. Please do stand. We're going to sing.